Well, on our recent trip up to Idaho to go see Yellowstone National Park, we stayed in a cabin in Island Park, Idaho, in a small subdivision of other cabins. Some of these cabins were small, some of them were pretty big, but there was one cabin that the locals called the Ghost Cabin. And the Ghost Cabin had been started a number of years ago by someone with grand intentions. He wanted to have his massive three-story multi-room cabin overlooking the river. The problem was, the man did not count the cost. And a point came where he could no longer afford to keep building this cabin. And for several years now, the cabin has fallen into disrepair. Unfinished. It's now full of animals, broken windows, and broken dreams. It really would be a fine cabin if somebody would come along and finish it. But they better know how much it would cost to finish it. Or else, just like the man who started it the first time around, he'd be a man with broken dreams as well. Have your Bibles open to Luke chapter 14. We are going to be looking at a passage where Jesus explains to his disciples just what it means to count the cost of discipleship, to count the cost of service to him, and a life spent working for something bigger than yourself. And we'll come back to this ghost cabin here in a little while. But let's begin in Luke chapter 14 and verse 25. Now great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." That seems like awfully strong language. So let's keep things in the context of our family vacation to Yellowstone for just a few more minutes. It wasn't just us that came to Yellowstone. Taylor was there also. But my parents, my younger brother and his family, my older brother and his family, 15 Goodwins in all, got together to share this cabin. Not this cabin, obviously. And so a passage like this really speaks to me in that context, because in a wonderful week of vacation, I saw my father and my mother, my wife and my children, my brothers and my sisters-in-law. And then to hear Jesus say, if you do not hate all of these people, well, you're not worthy of me. You're not worthy of the kingdom. So I wonder, what does Jesus really mean when he says, you must hate your own father and mother? That seems awfully hard to do, especially considering what was written in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1, where the Apostle Paul says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. How can I hate my father and mother while at the same time being told in another passage to honor my father and my mother? How can I hate my wife when I'm told in Ephesians chapter 5 that as a husband, the way that Jesus loves his bride, the church, I'm supposed to love my wife, Rebecca? I think another passage sheds some light on this. If you'll notice in Matthew chapter 10, where Jesus uses similar language, just said in a different way, I think it gives us another way to think about this idea. Begin in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 34. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. That's quoting Micah chapter 7 and verse 6. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. Now remember, this is all in the context of when he said earlier that the whole world is going to hate you on account of my name. He says in verse 37 of Matthew 10, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, and he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. And he concludes in verse 39, he who has found his life shall lose it, he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it. I believe Jesus is saying the same thing in both of these passages, just in a slightly different way. In Matthew's account, he says, you cannot love your mother or father, son or daughter more than you love me, more than you love God. In Luke's account, he says, you must hate your father and your mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters. And if you do not hate them, you cannot be my disciple. Remember that when Jesus preaches and teaches, he often uses hyperbole, exaggeration to prove his point. So when Jesus says you must hate your father and your mother, he says you must hate them only compared to how much you love God first. Your love for God should be so high that your affection for your father and your mother and your wife and your children would seem like hate only in comparison to that. This does not mean to literally hate your parents and hate your family members. But your love for God should be so much higher. Now, here's the challenge for us. This is the practical challenge for all of us. If my love for Rebecca is right here, and my love for my family members, my mother, father, children, is somewhere right around here, very close to that as well, I might be willing to make a concession and say, well, I'll love God more than Rebecca, and I'll love God more than my children, but I'm only going to love God this much more. I'll love God a little bit more. Yes, I'll concede that. I know I'm commanded to love God more than everybody else. I get that. I understand that. But I'm only going to love Him a little bit more. No, what Jesus is saying is, if your love for father, mother, spouse, and children is right here, your love for God should be so far through the roof that this seems like hatred compared to that. Are you willing to commit fully to God? Are you willing to have that kind of love for Him? Because I fear that a lot of Christians don't. We love the things of this world so very, very much. And a lot of things in this world are worth loving. My family is worth loving. You are worth loving. But God is worth more. So much more. And the thing is that if your love for family is right here and your love for God is only right here, when those two things butt heads with each other, when those two things are in conflict with each other somehow, can you honestly say that God will win out in that fight in your heart? After all, in that Matthew chapter 10 account, what did Jesus say? I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring a sword. My message is going to divide families so that you're going to have to choose at some point, I will either love the things of this world or I will love God. And I can't have it both ways when those two things are in conflict with each other. Do you really honestly think that if your love for God and family is that close, that you're going to be able to say in the heat of that moment that God will win? Now, that's something I can't answer for you. So we'll leave it at that and move on. He uses the language of carrying your own cross back in Luke chapter 14, verse 27. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. That's pretty definitive, isn't it? If you will not carry your cross and come follow after Jesus, you cannot be a disciple of Christ. There's no halfway there. There's no entry-level membership. It's not like at Costco or Sam's Club where you can get the basic package, and if you feel like it later on, you can become a Gold Star member. If you are not fully committed, you are not actually committed. If you are not fully committed, you are not actually committed. You cannot be a disciple of Christ if you think you can only do it halfway. Now, let's think about the cross a little bit here. Because this was before Jesus was crucified. All of this language of picking up your cross and carrying it, coming after me. None of his disciples at this point would have connected the cross to him. We connect the cross to Jesus because we have the benefit of hindsight. We know how the story ends. But Peter and James and John, none of those who were listening here in Luke 14 knew that that was going to be the end of the story. they were only just now starting to grasp that Jesus would have to die at all. And they did not understand at this point the specifics of that death. Now, we might hear the language of pick up your cross and follow after Jesus, and for us, that is a very positive thing. We'll have a cross tattooed on our arm. We'll wear a cross as a necklace around there. We'll put a cross on the top of a church building. To us, the cross is a very positive, beautiful image because of everything that it means, everything that it entails. But his disciples would not have seen it that way. They had no reason to see it that way. For them, at this point, the only thing they would have known about a cross is that that was a criminal's death. So how strange is that language then? Don't read it from the perspective of a Christian. Read it from the perspective of people who have no idea that the cross was going to become a very powerful image in that regard. All they saw was Jesus saying, "You better pick up your electric chair and come follow after me. You better gather a firing squad with you and bring that firing squad along with you. Get the syringe that's used to kill you, and you better put that syringe in your pocket and come follow after me." That's all they would have heard Jesus saying. That makes the message even more challenging, doesn't it? When you consider it from its context. There's no false advertising here as well. Did Jesus promise them that it would be an abundant life, physically speaking, or that it was going to be easy? Connect this again to Matthew chapter 10. The whole world will hate you on account of my name. If they so treated the teacher, and they have so treated the master, how do you think they're going to treat the student and the servant? What do you think? I appreciate Jesus very much all the more because of the honesty that he showed. That when you become a follower, a disciple of Jesus, what he promises is not wealth or physical health. Rather, what he promises explicitly is suffering. Earlier in our worship service, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12 was read. I like in particular the way Peter starts this passage by saying, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing as though some strange thing were happening to you." Because, quite frankly, if you had ever read Matthew 10, and if you had ever read Luke 14, and if you had ever heard Jesus preaching, and if you were there when his disciples first began preaching in the book of Acts, you would not have been surprised by the fiery ordeal which comes upon you. Now, what's hard for us? What's hard for us is that we live a relatively comfortable life. I say relatively, and I'm not even sure that word really gives the sense of our life. There is no generation of human beings, Christian or otherwise, that has lived as comfortably as 21st century Americans have. So every time we feel the slightest pain from our faith, every time we endure the slightest persecution of some kind, a friend making fun of us, a coworker who won't sit with us at the cafeteria anymore, we're so shocked by that. And yet Peter just reiterates what Jesus said. Don't be surprised by it. You knew going into it that it would be hard. So when it gets hard, don't act like this is something that came out of the blue. So what's your cross? What is the thing that you're not willing to pick up? Because I think it's different for everybody. In Matthew chapter 19, for the rich young ruler, the cross that he needed to pick up was selling all of his possessions, giving them to the poor, and following after Jesus. That was his cross. That was the thing that he was not willing to pick up. What's your cross? Maybe it is career. And some sacrifice was asked of you at some point in your career where you could have either missed out on a raise, on a promotion, but you would have had to make some compromise for your faith. Or you could have stuck to your faith and missed out on the career. What is your cross? What is the thing that is hardest for you to pick up that Jesus, like in Matthew 19, would say, there's one thing lacking. Pick it up. Let's begin in verse 28 now, back in Luke 14. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him. This man, they say, began to build, and he was not able to finish. Or what king, in verse 31, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while he is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Counting the cost. Counting the cost. Everybody ridicules the guy who started building this cabin there in Island Park, Idaho. We probably all have the person in our neighborhood, the guy with the lofty dreams, the big ideas. He's going to do an addition to the back of his house or make an Arizona sunroom. He's going to dig his own pool out. We all have that neighbor. We all have that guy in our neighborhood. And we all ridicule. Now, I'm sure Christians are nicer about it than other people are. We're supposed to be. I think this was expected of us. But to a degree, I think Jesus is pointing out, you look at people like that in the world, and you know instantly what their situation is. You know instantly what their deal is. This man began to build, and he couldn't afford to finish it. This person saw getting dunked in water as a relatively easy thing to do. For the first few months, this person felt like coming to worship was a very light sacrifice to give to God. The burden was very easy. But this person did not count the cost. And when things started getting harder, when more was required of him or her, when their faith was tested, they fell away. They couldn't finish building it. We talk about so often, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. This is so true of a person's spiritual life. Because we all start like a seed, don't we? We all start with the Word of God implanted, and we grow and we grow and we grow. But like Jesus pointed out in the parable of the sower, it really isn't where you start, because several of those seeds were capable of growing, at least at first. Some of them didn't have a strong root, though, and they died off. Some of them surrounded themselves with weeds that were noxious, that consumed them and killed them off. We all have the opportunity to grow. We all start very small. But some are not going to make it to the finish line. This way to mix metaphors right there. Because some didn't count the cost. Let's make a couple of applications here about counting the cost before we move on. First of all, I think it is very important for us to learn how to sit down before we get up to build. Look what he says again in verse 28. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost? In life, we have to learn to sit down before we can get up and get moving. There's so many projects that we engage in that we didn't measure properly. We didn't think through it all. We didn't make the costs. We didn't think through the whole process. We didn't sit down first. It's okay to sit down. It's okay to think through it. It's okay to take your time. Study something out before you come to a conclusion. Learn to sit before you get up to build. Sometimes it does matter what other people think. Now, it says there in verse 38, they were ridiculing him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. And I think people of the world would look at that and go, it doesn't matter what people think. Don't listen to others. Don't listen to them when they make fun of you. Don't listen to them when they ridicule you. And to a degree, I understand that. But you know, the flip side of that coin is, Sometimes people are absolutely right when they make fun of you. Now, it doesn't necessarily justify it if their approach is rude or crude, or if their desire is to tear you down and ruin your self-esteem. That doesn't make it right necessarily. But sometimes when we're ridiculed by people, we kind of pat ourselves on the back and go, "There, there, you don't have to listen to what other people say. It doesn't matter what they think." Well, you know what? It kind of does. It kind of does. And whether they're right or wrong for making fun of you and however it is they do it, maybe we should learn to take a lesson from those who ridicule us. Don't be sensitive about the downfall that you brought on yourself, because blaming others doesn't fix it. The guy who built that cabin, it could be very, very easy for him to say, "Well, the neighbors are always insulting me. The bank wasn't very cooperative. My contractor didn't listen to what I had to say." But at the end of the day, you didn't count the cost. So stop being sensitive about what other people think about you and learn to take responsibility for it when you have failed in something. Some battles are too big for you. Learn your limits and respect them. If you only have 10,000 soldiers in a battle and your opponent has 20,000 soldiers and you have counted the cost and you have calculated the risk, if you know that you can't win that battle, don't engage in that battle. It's okay to just let some things go. Learn when you are going to fail. Learn what your weaknesses are, especially when it comes to sin. And if certain people and certain situations and certain substances always lead to your sin, then it is time for you to learn to quit trying to fight that battle. Stay away from those people. Stay away from those places. Stay away from those substances. There is no real glory in Pyrrhic victories and wasted resources. The term Pyrrhic victory comes from a man named Pyrrhus, who was king, and he fought against the Romans. He actually was successful in two battles against the Romans, two battles in a row. And yet he commented to his counselors, "A few more victories like that, and we'll have to surrender." Because he might have won the battle, he might have won a tactical victory against the Romans, but he didn't have the population to support more war. He might have lost fewer men than the Romans. He might have won the field that day, but the Romans could fill in the holes. They had another 1,000 men they could put in the battle, another 10,000 men. They had another 1,000,000 people in their population they could draw from. And so the Romans could afford to lose those battles, but Pyrrhus and his people could not. So let's stop glorying in our failures as if they were some kind of victory. There's no real glory in that sort of thing when you waste all of your resources on endeavors that prove empty. Empty cabins don't make anybody happy. So really it boils down to discipleship, and that's verse 33. "So therefore no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." What does the word disciple even mean? Means to give yourself wholly to somebody else. In service, you see the word discipline comes from the word disciple. You are willing to sacrifice yourself in the service of somebody else. You are willing to give up on what your preferences are and your own dreams and your own personal desires to serve a bigger purpose found in somebody or something else. But discipleship also has its rewards. Jesus doesn't just leave you empty right here. Because what does he promise? For those who are his disciples indeed, they might give up their physical life for him. They might give up their possessions for him. They might give up worldly accolades and treasures. They might give up a legacy left on planet Earth. But it's like Jesus said, when you lose your life for my sake, you're actually gaining life. Will you please count the cost? If you have already been baptized, if you have already made your confession of faith in our Savior Jesus Christ, if you have already done the things that are asked of you in the gospel to become a Christian, will you please count the cost of continued discipleship? And if your faith is waning, if you're losing ground to Satan, then it is time for you to come back. It is time for you to recommit yourself to God. If you're not a Christian, though, will you please count the cost? I am tired of seeing people come to Christ and 6 months later having no idea where they are. Are you tired of that as well? Are you tired of the souls that slip out, that fall between the cracks, that leave a little bit at a time, and eventually you don't see them ever again? Will you please count the cost? And if you're going to become a Christian, why won't you become a Christian for your life? And if you're going to give your life over to Christ, don't give Him just 6 months. It's not a trial period, my friends. You're not testing out the waters of Christianity. Will you please count the cost? So at the end of all things, when this life is over and you leave behind all the junk that this life has to offer, you will be in heaven with every other saint. Will you please count the cost? And if you have any need at all, then come forward as we stand and sing.